Chapter 21. Pitt had expected to trudge through snow in January on Kunghit Island, but only a light blanket of the white stuff had fallen on the ground, and much of that had melted since the last storm. He pulled Stokes along behind him on a travoy, a device used for hauling burdens by American Plains Indians. He couldn't leave Stokes, and to attempt carrying the Mountie on his back was inviting internal hemorrhaging. So he lashed two dead branch poles together with cargo tie-down straps he scrounged in the wreckage of the aircraft. Rigging a platform between the poles and a harness on one end, he strapped Stokes to the middle of the travoy. Then, throwing the harness end over his shoulders, Pitt began dragging the injured Mountie through the woods. Hour followed hour, the sun set and night came on as he struggled north through the darkness, setting his course by the compass he'd removed from the aircraft's instrument panel, an expedient he had used several years previously when trekking across the Sahara Desert. Every 10 minutes or so, Pitt asked Stokes, "You still with me?" "Hanging in," the Mountie repeated weakly. "I'm looking at a shallow stream that runs to the west." "You've come to Wolf Creek. Cross it and head northwest." "How much farther to Broadmoor's village?" Stokes replied in a hoarse murmur, 2, maybe 3 kilometers. "Keep talking to me, you hear?" "You sound like my wife." "You married?" 10 years. "To a great lady who gave me 5 children. Pitt readjusted the harness straps, which were cutting into his chest, and pulled Stokes across the stream. After plodding through the underbrush for 1 kilometer, he came to a faint path that led in the direction he was headed. The path was grown over in places, but it offered relatively free passage, a godsend to Pitt after having forced his way through woods thick with shrubs growing between the trees. Twice he thought he'd lost the path, but after continuing on the same course for several meters, he would pick it up again. Despite the freezing temperature, his exertions were making him sweat. He dared not allow himself to stop and rest. If Stokes was to live to see his wife and 5 children again, Pitt had to keep going. He kept up a one-way conversation with the Mountie, fervently trying to keep him from drifting into a coma from shock. Concentrating on keeping 1 foot moving ahead of the other, Pitt failed to recognize anything strange. Stokes whispered something, but Pitt couldn't make it out. He turned his head, cocked an ear, and paused. "You want me to stop?" Pitt asked.
"Smell it?"
Stokes barely whispered.
"Smell what?"
"Smoke." Then Pitt had it too. He inhaled deeply. The scent of wood smoke was coming from somewhere ahead. He was tired, desperately tired. But he leaned forward against the harness and staggered on. Soon his ears picked up the sound of a small gas engine, of a chainsaw cutting into wood. The wood smell became stronger, and he could see smoke drifting over the tops of the trees in the early light of dawn. His heart was pounding under the strain, but he wasn't about to quit this close to his destination. The sun rose but remained hidden behind dark gray clouds. A light drizzle was falling when he stumbled into a clearing that touched the sea and opened onto a small harbor. He found himself staring at a small community of log houses with corrugated metal roofs. Smoke was rising out of their stone chimneys. Tall cylindrical totem poles were standing in different parts of the village, carved with the features of stacked animal and human figures. A small fleet of fishing boats rocked gently beside a floating dock, their crews working over engines and repairing nets. Several children, standing under a shed with open sides, were observing a man carving a huge log with a chainsaw. 2 women chatted as they hung wash on a line. One of them spotted Pitt, pointed and began shouting at the others. Overcome by exhaustion, Pitt sank to his knees as a crowd of 12 people rushed toward him. 1 man, with long straight black hair and a round face, knelt down beside Pitt and put an arm around his shoulder.
"You're all right now," he said with concern.
He motioned to three men who gathered around Stokes and gave them an order. "Carry him into the tribal house." Pitt looked at the man. "You wouldn't by chance be Mason Broadmoor?" Coal-black eyes stared at him curiously. "Why, yes, I am." "Boy," said Pitt as he sagged bone-weary to the soft ground, "am I ever glad to see you." The nervous giggle of a little girl roused Pitt from a light sleep. Tired as he was, he'd only slept 4 hours. He opened his eyes, stared at her a moment, gave her a bright smile, and crossed his eyes. She ran out of the room, yelling for her mother. He was in a cozy room with a small stove radiating wondrous heat, lying in a bed made up of bear and wolf hides. He smiled to himself at the recollection of Broadmoor standing in the middle of an isolated Indian village with few modern conveniences, calling over his satellite phone for an air ambulance to transport Stokes to a hospital on the mainland. Pitt had borrowed the phone to contact the Mountie office at Shearwater. At the mention of Stokes' name, he was immediately put through to an Inspector Pendleton, who questioned Pitt in detail about the events commencing the previous morning. Pitt ended the briefing by giving Pendleton directions to the crash site so the Mounties could send in a team to retrieve the cameras inside the pontoons, if they had survived the impact. A seaplane arrived before Pitt had finished a bowl of fish soup that was thrust on him by Broadmoor's wife. Two paramedics and a doctor examined Stokes and assured Pitt the Mountie had every chance of pulling through. Only after the seaplane had lifted off the water on its flight back to the mainland and the nearest hospital had Pitt gratefully accepted the loan of the Broadmoor family bed and fallen dead asleep. Broadmoor's wife entered from the main living room and kitchen. A woman of grace and poise, stout yet supple, Irma Broadmoor had haunting coffee eyes and a laughing mouth.
"How are you feeling, Mr. Pitt? I didn't expect you to wake up for another 3 hours at least."
Pitt checked and made sure he still wore his pants and shirt before he threw back the covers and dropped his bare feet to the floor. "I'm sorry to have put you and your husband out of your bed." She laughed, a light musical laugh.
"The time is a little past noon. You've only been asleep since 8 o'clock.
"I'm most grateful for your hospitality."
"You must be hungry. That bowl of fish soup wasn't enough for a big man like you. What would you like to eat?"
"A can of beans will be fine."
"People sitting around a campfire eating canned beans in the North Woods is a myth. I'll grill some salmon steaks. I hope you like salmon."
"I do indeed."
"While you're waiting, you can talk to Mason. He's working outside."
Pitt pulled on his socks and hiking boots, ran his hands through his hair, and faced the world. He found Broadmoor in the open shed, chiseling away on a 5-meter-long red cedar log that lay horizontal on 4 heavy-duty sawhorses. Broadmoor was attacking it with a round wooden mallet, shaped like a bell, and a concave chisel called a fantail gouge. The carving was not far enough along for Pitt to visualize the finished product. The faces of animals were still in the rough stage. Broadmoor looked up as Pitt approached.
"Have a good rest?"
"I didn't know bear skins were so soft." Broadmoor smiled.
"Don't let the word out or they'll be extinct within a year."
"Ed Posey told me you carved totem poles. I've never seen one in the works before."
"My family have been carvers for generations. Totems evolved because the early Indians of the Northwest had no written language. Family histories and legends were preserved by carving symbols, usually animals on red cedar trees."
"Do they have religious significance?" asked Pitt. Broadmoor shook his head.
"They were never worshipped as icons of gods, but respected more as guardian spirits."
"What are the symbols on this pole?"
"This is a mortuary pole, or what you might call a commemorative column. The pole is in honor of my uncle, who passed away last week. When I finish the carvings, they will illustrate his personal crest, which was an eagle and a bear,
along with a traditional Haida figure of the deceased. After completion, it will be erected during a feast at the corner of his widow's house. As a respected master carver, you must be booked up for many months in advance. Broadmoor shrugged modestly. Almost 2 years. Do you know why I'm here? Pitt asked, and the abrupt question caught Broadmoor with the mallet raised to strike the fantail gouge. The woodcarver laid his tools aside and motioned for Pitt to follow him to the edge of the harbor, where he stopped beside a small boathouse that extended into the water. He opened the doors and stepped inside. Two small craft floated within a U-shaped dock. "Are you into jet skis?" asked Pitt. Broadmoor smiled. "I believe the term is now watercraft." Pitt studied the pair of sleek Duo 300 wet jets by Mastercraft Boats. High-performance craft that could seat two people, they were vividly painted with Haida animal symbols. "They look like they can almost fly." "Over water they do. I modified their engines to gain another 15 horsepower. They move along at almost 50 knots." Broadmoor suddenly changed the subject. "Ed Posey said you wanted to circle Kunghit Island with acoustic measuring equipment. I thought the watercraft might be an efficient means of conducting your project." "They'd be ideal. Unfortunately, my hydrophone gear was badly damaged when Stokes and I crashed. The only other avenue left open to me is to probe the mine itself." "What do you hope to discover?" "The method of excavation Dorset is using to retrieve the diamonds." Broadmoor picked up a pebble at the waterline and threw it far out into the deep green water. "The company has a small fleet of boats patrolling the waters around the island," he said finally. "They're armed and have been known to attack fishermen who venture too close." "It seems Canadian government officials didn't tell me all I needed to know," said Pitt, cursing Posey under his breath. "I guess they figured since you were under their license to do field research, you wouldn't be harassed by the mine's security." "Your brother. Stokes mentioned the assault and burning of his boat." He pointed back toward the partially carved totem pole. "Did he also tell you they killed my uncle?" Pitt shook his head slowly. "No, I'm sorry. I found his body floating 8 kilometers out to sea. He had lashed himself to a pair of fuel cans. The water was cold and he died of exposure. All we ever found of his fishing boat was a piece of the wheelhouse." "You think Dorset security people murdered him?" "I know they murdered him," Broadmoor said, anger in his eyes. "What about the law?" Broadmoor shook his head. "Inspector Stokes only represents a token investigative force. After Arthur Dorset sent his prospecting geologists swarming all over the islands until they found the main diamond source on Kunghit, he used his power and wealth to literally take over the island from the government. Never mind that the Haida claim the island as tribal sacred ground. Now it is illegal for any of my people to set foot on the island without permission, or to fish within 4 kilometers of its shore. We can be arrested by the Mounties who are paid to protect us." "I see why the mine's chief of security has so little regard for the law." "Merchant, Dapper John as he's called," Broadmoor said, pure hatred in his round face. "Lucky you escaped. Chances are you'd have simply disappeared. Many men have attempted to search for diamonds in and around the island. None were successful, and none were ever seen again." "Has any of the diamond wealth gone to the Haida?" Pitt asked. "So far we've been screwed," answered Broadmoor. "Whether wealth from the diamonds will come to us has become more illegal than a political issue. We've negotiated for years in an attempt to get a piece of the action, but Dorset's attorneys have stalled us in the courts." "I can't believe the Canadian government allows Arthur Dorset to dictate to them."
The country's economy is on the ropes, and the politicians close their eyes to payoffs and corruption, while embracing any special interest that slips money into the treasury. He paused and stared into Pitt's eyes as if trying to read something.
"What is your interest, Mr. Pitt? Do you want to shut the mine down?"
Pitt nodded. "I do, providing I can prove their excavation is causing the acoustic plague responsible for the mass killing of humans and sea life."
He looked at Pitt. "I will take you inside the mining property."
Pitt considered the offer briefly.
"You have a wife and children. No sense in risking two lives. Put me on the island and I'll figure a way to get over the mound without being seen."
"Can't be done. Their security systems are state-of-the-art. A squirrel can't get past them, as proven by their little bodies that litter the mound, along with those of hundreds of other animals that inhabited the island before Dorset's mining operation gutted what was once a beautiful environment. And then there are the Alsatian police dogs that can smell out a diamond-smuggling intruder at 100 meters.
There's always the tunnel.
You'll never get through it alone.
Better that than your wife becoming another widow."
"You don't understand," Broadmoor said patiently. His eyes burned with consuming flames of revenge. "The mine pays my tribal community to keep their kitchen stocked with fresh fish. Once a week, my neighbors and I sail to Kung Hit and deliver our catch. At the docks, we load it on carts and transport the fish through the tunnel to the office of the head cook. He serves us breakfast, pays us in cash, not nearly what the catch is worth, and then we leave. You've got black hair. You could pass for a Haida if you wear fisherman's work clothes and keep your head down. The guards are more concerned with diamonds smuggled out of camp than fish coming in. Since we only deliver and take nothing, we're not suspect."
"Are there no good paying jobs for your people at the mine?"
Broadmoor shrugged. "To forget how to fish and hunt is to forget independence. The monies we make stocking their kitchen goes toward a new school for our children."
"There's a small problem. Dapper John Merchant. We've met and struck up a mutual dislike. He had a close look at my face."
Broadmoor waved a hand airily. "Merchant recognizing you is not a problem. He'd never soil his expensive Italian shoes by hanging around the tunnel and kitchens. In this weather, he seldom shows his face outside his office."
"I won't be able to gather much information from the kitchen help," said Pitt.
"Do you know any miners you can trust to describe the excavation procedures?"
"All the mine workers are Chinese, illegally brought in by criminal syndicates. None speak English. Your best hope is an old mining engineer who hates Dorset Consolidated with a passion."
"Can you contact him?"
"I don't even know his name.
He works the graveyard shift and usually eats breakfast about the same time we deliver our fish. We've talked a few times over a cup of coffee. He's not happy about the working conditions. During our last conversation, he claimed that in the past year over 20 Chinese workers have died in the mines."
"If I can get 10 minutes alone with him, he might be of great help in solving the acoustics enigma."
"No guarantee he'll be there when we make the delivery," said Broadmoor.
"I'll have to gamble," Pitt said thoughtfully. "When do you deliver your next catch?"
"The last of our village fleet should be docking within a few hours. We'll ice and crate the catch later this evening and be ready to head for Kung Hit Island at first light."
Pitt wondered if he was physically and mentally primed to lay his life on the line again. Then he thought of the hundreds of dead bodies he'd seen on the cruise ship, and there wasn't the slightest doubt about what he must do.